Legislature. It is Monday, March the 5th, 2007. Today we will have public hearings starting with House Bill 2601 and 2688, and then we'll move into House Bill 2107, 2221, and at the end, if time allows, House Bill 2781. So with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2601. Representative Crummell. I don't have a sign-up sheet, but I bet you should be on it if you're not.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Great to have you back. I think we saw you Friday. So today we're talking about House Bill 2601. So I'm going to let Steve give us a little preview of it, and then maybe you can elaborate a little more on it.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Steve?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2601 establishes a manufactured structure relocation fund that's separate and distinct from the general fund.
Thank you. Representative Crummell, would you like to tell us a little bit about this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, which is Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. House Bill 2601 is a bill that will establish the relocation fund, and then we've also been working with OHCS, Oregon Housing Community Services, on some amendments that will make it easier and better for them in terms of administering the fund. On Friday when we were here, I mentioned that we had spent, you know, about the last 18 months talking with people about the park closures when they've been uprooted and what their biggest problem is. And we've talked with housing advocates, local government folks, and as well as park owners. And one of the biggest complaints that we hear is cash. A lot of the folks that are displaced when a mobile home park closes don't have the money necessarily to front the cost of moving the house. And even though in other parts of the legislation that we've been working on, there are some other things to try to help with that, there still is a possibility that a person is not going to necessarily have the funds that they would need to be able to make the move, to move the home from one park to another or to another piece of property and that sort of thing. And, you know, for a person that's on a fixed income, and even with a tax credit, you know, $10,000 to $20,000 can seem like a lifetime away as far as being able to raise that money. So we wanted to try to find a way that when a person is in a cash crunch, that they would be able to do that. And that's why we came up with 2601. It, in essence, is two things. It's a revolving cash, loan fund, and it also is a grant fund. So part of the bill, we would earmark $10 million for this, and it would be a one-time allocation. We would then give the OHCS the ability, in some cases, to do low-interest or no-interest loans, and also to use part of the money for grants. Now, of course, the question is, okay, if you use part of the money for grants, and grants means it's never going to come back, what are we going to do? That would mean that hopefully the department in their budget would put dollars in that would be used for a grant, but in future Bidens. But the idea on this time is because of the crunch that we're in with folks and the park closures occurring, that we could put the money into this fund. Hopefully the interest generated on the money and paid back using the tax credit or other financing would keep the fund going for a few years. And it's very possible that on low interest loans, if there were enough of them, that would help fund the grant program as well. And as I mentioned, we're working with OHCS on some amendments. One is that the household would be able to borrow up to $10,000, and the money wouldn't have to necessarily be used just for moving, but they could also use that for purchasing as going into a common fund to help purchase the park. If that's where, you know, if there was an agreed upon price and, you know, willing seller, willing buyer, sort of a deal. So it would allow the residents to be able to join with other residents in a park and form a co-op or a homeowners association or other mechanism that's listed in statute where they could purchase the park. And as I mentioned, and I think OHCS is supportive of the bill. That's been their indication to me anyways, that they're supportive. They did ask that we put together some amendments, which we worked with them on, and I hope that you have the dash one amendments, Mr. Chair, or that the administrator does. And if not, then I'll make sure that you get the dash one amendments. Do you have the dash one amendments?
We haven't seen those at this time. So,
one second, Mr. Chair.
You could maybe just briefly tell us what the dash one amendments do.
Yes, I would be glad to, Mr. Chair, and my apologies for you not getting them. I thought that we had passed those on to you. Basically, that it would allow the state treasurer to reinvest the money to get earnings and that the funds would accrue to the fund itself. Excuse me, that the interest on monies would accrue to the fund and not just go into the general fund. We also put in some technical language that OHCS had requested so that they could to make it easier for them to administer the funds and to administer the loan program. And also we clarified some language on primarily on the second page of the bill that makes it certain that the amount that is either loaned or granted or combination is not does not exceed $10,000 on a per household basis. So those are the and then we're giving the department the ability to adopt rules. And then the other thing is that for purposes of any past due obligations on that are assigned by the Department of Revenue have priority over other delinquent accounts in terms of collections. And I hope I probably made that about as clear as mud. But that's basically what the amendments do. So as I mentioned, there's some the technical sorts of things that OHCS had requested, as well as clarifications.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Premel. Thanks for being here. Has it been recommended to you that the name of this fund be changed to the Manufactured Structure Relocation and Facility Purchase Fund?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson. It would be the Manufactured Structure Relocation Fund. Yes.
And Facility Purchase Fund.
That's not necessarily in the amendments, but I guess it could be considered and facility purchase fund.
Okay. Thank you. And another follow-up, please?
Please. Go ahead.
And on page one, following at line 21, let's see, after the five, it says here, to insert... or who seek to purchase the facility in which they reside, who receive a notice of termination of tenancy under ORS 90.630, parentheses 5, or who seek to purchase the facility in which they reside, would that be acceptable?
The way legislative counsel has put the amendment is that it would be or who wish to pursue the purchase of the manufactured dwelling park in which the manufactured structure owners reside.
They've made it very
clear in the dash one amendments. And I'm sorry, you don't have the dash one amendments in
the I just now got them, so I don't know. Okay. And let me just ask if I can have a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Nelson.
Just to be sure, please. Okay, so then after line 28, almost have to read the whole sentence. In making loans that include fund monies, the department and financial institution shall give preference to borrowers applying the loan proceeds toward the payment of manufactured structure, moving, and setup costs. And right then, can we insert our purchase of the facility, purchase of a portion of the facility, or contributing to a corporation or association that purchases a facility or a portion of the facility? Has that been brought up to you, Representative Crummell, that amendment? It's, once again, it's just giving clarity to, you know, with this new name, to the opportunity to purchase a facility or a portion of it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I certainly would be amenable to looking at this is the first time that I've heard the language that you're suggesting also, and without having it in front of me, it's hard to tell what it would do, but I don't have any problem making the bill clearer and making sure that people understand what it can be used for. I would encourage you, either through the committee administrator or on your own, go ahead and ask Legislative Council to draft the language that you're looking at, and then of course if the committee wishes to insert it, but I'd be happy to work with you on that as well.
Thank you very much.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Crummell, I'm sort of curious about the anticipation of the agencies to in fact direct the funds out of the general fund into this fund, and you know, the likelihood of, you know, that running into a little bit of trouble in the Ways and Means process, perhaps, because I don't believe this bill is anticipated in the governor's budget. Have you thought about other financing mechanisms to basically put the money into this fund?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why, yes, I have. I have a companion bill in that is, well, it's not really a companion, but the interesting thing is nobody wanted to sign on with it, with me on it, and I just can't understand why. But what the bill would do, you never want to suggest that we spend additional money without having a source for it. And the source that I chose was the political tax credit to eliminate it. And it just so happens that about the amount of money that, if you look at your tax expenditure report book, that goes through for the political tax credit is right around $10 million. Isn't that amazing how the two line up? And so I think that by eliminating the political tax credit, that would provide us with the potential $10 million that then we could divert into this fund. I think it would be a much better use of the money than giving candidates for office credit or giving them, you know, I mean, if people want to contribute, they're going to contribute anyway, irrespective of the political tax credit. So I don't think the political tax credit is something that's necessarily really needed.
I think that may be an arguable point, but we won't argue it here.
Well, I do know that there's been some folks that have, sort of said that wouldn't be a good idea for a variety of reasons, of which you're right. We probably shouldn't go into
So any further questions, Representative Crummell?
Mr. Chair?
One more, Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you. I just want to ask you, Representative Crummell, because I didn't realize we had so much money in our facilities budget. There are huge sums of money that are loaned out, and I just read it the other day, and I thought, my goodness, why isn't this being used? And so since these are park purchases possibilities, I wonder if you might get with Randall Edwards and look at that fund. There's a lot of money sitting there.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, in looking at the, I'm also on a Ways and Means Subcommittee of General Government Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and we in fact did look at the Treasurer's budget, and we have already sent it to the full Ways and Means. As a matter of fact, there are a number of dollars that are in the facility program. However, most of that money is already earmarked, and it's not necessarily used in a way that is used to help people in this kind of a situation, or in any, that is primarily for facilities that the state of Oregon would own. And I would argue that when a park is going to close, I don't think it would be up to the state of Oregon necessarily to buy and own and operate mobile home parks. I don't think that would be a good use of our resources.
One quick remark.
Just ask another one.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, in there I noticed that there were a number of dollars loaned for housing projects. So just for what it's worth, I just hope we don't separate these people that live in manufactured parks, you know, from the others that are getting their housing, their apartments, condos, units. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I think that of course, is an arguable point in terms of dollars that are used by the department for, but those are generally, and the department can answer this question better for you than I can, I think, but those dollars are generally used for not necessarily a relocation, but for low interest type of loans for people to develop apartments and that sort of thing. I'm not sure that a park would necessarily fall into that kind of a category, but it would certainly be worth asking them about.
Any further questions for Representative Kremel? Seeing none, thank you very much for bringing this forward. I think it offers an interesting concept, perhaps, that we might be able to use to help solve this problem, and I appreciate your leadership and your thought in bringing these forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity.
Next up, I want to perhaps see if L.L. Simpson is in the audience. And is there anyone else or a department person that wishes to speak to this bill this time? Anybody else in the audience? House Bill 2601. Seeing none, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2601 and open a hearing on House Bill 2688. L.L. Simpson is not in the audience. D.E. Brown. J. Taylor. Give us a summary, Steve. Since nobody else is still enough to talk about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2688, which we, if I can remind the committee, we briefly heard this on Friday when we gaveled out to take testimony from a Bend City Councilor and Representative Burley. But House Bill 2688 expands the tax credit to include credit for costs incurred in the purchase of manufactured dwelling facility by tenants.
Thank you. Seeing nobody that's willing to testify on this, does the committee have any questions? I know you're going to direct them to, but maybe we could get a running list of questions, perhaps.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nelson.
Okay, you would never guess why this is of such great concern to me, but this industry is the reason I'm ended up here in Oregon, so I'm really attuned to them. But I have a recommendation. If you look at House Bill 2688, that from constituents at lines 27 and 28 be deleted, and you know, it's stating the income level of families, and I'm not sure that that's the purpose of this being in this bill. And then
is that page one?
Yes, sir, page one, lines 27 and 28. And then on page two, after line 36, let's see. Hopefully this is what is wished, that on line 34 we could take it through the 2007 Act period. Let's see. Where am I? Right here. Oh, no. The last 007. That would be line 36. And take out the end before January 1, 2008. I'm not sure we need to be that specific. But anyway, if possible, you could consider that. Those, both of those as amendments, we would be grateful.
So noted.
So
Representative Riley.
Thank you. So what you're asking is that we take all the limits off of income for this. Is that right?
Of this one, that yes. Question, Mr. Chair?
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, and I apologize if this was covered Friday during my absence, but was there some testimony presented about the income level of people who live in these parks? Or if we're talking about getting rid of the income level in this bill, are we talking about just a handful of people?
Yes, I believe I asked that question in committee, and we didn't have an answer for that. And I don't remember. Maybe Steve could follow up and find out who was going to provide us with that information. So, because I asked the income level demographics of,
okay,
of the mobile home park owners or follow tenants, up. I okay. suppose.
That would be useful to know if we're talking about removing the income level for the tax credit.
It would be necessary.
Mr. Chair, I did think we were in line with the federal poverty guideline in this, but I'll have to look again. Oh, yes, on the second page.
Any further questions or comments from the committee? Last call for anyone who wants to testify on House Bill 2688 from the audience. Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2688. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2107. Could we have Craig Smith from the Construction Contractors Board? Steve, give us a little preview of the bill before us, and we'll turn it over to the board.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2107 requires construction contractor to notify Construction Contractors Board of certain judgments or arbitration awards against the contractor.
Thank you. Craig, good to see you back on a Monday. You could give us a little preview or a little summary of 2107 and perhaps a comment on what the amendments accomplish in the overall scope of this bill.
Very good. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Craig Smith for the record, Construction Contractors Board. Before you have a fairly simple bill. This is the Bill 2107 that would require construction contractors to let the Construction Contractors Board they fail to pay a court judgment. Fairly simple concept. We have statutory authority to discipline a contractor for failing to pay a judgment, but from time to time we have contractors who have these unpaid judgments. We don't know about them. The creditors don't know that we exist. And in one case, we found out about a contractor that had millions of dollars of unpaid, as much as millions of dollars of unpaid court judgment and arbitration losses, and yet that contractor remained practicing for some period of time. This bill would require that the contractor have a duty to tell the licensing agency that they have this unpaid debt. The duty is only triggered if they lose in court or arbitration, and the arbitration has been reviewed by a court and made a court order, and that it is construction work, and it goes unpaid for 30 days. So we believe those triggers are important. The Dash 1 amendment better clarified that this is only court judgment, not just unpaid arbitration orders. Arbitration orders would be wrapped in as soon as they are brought to a court and the court has verified the arbitration award. We sure would appreciate your favorable consideration. We think it makes all kinds of sense. At this point, I've had no one approach me to suggest this is not a good idea. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Committee, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's a good idea as well. I had one question, however, and you may have told us this before, but what do you plan to do when they notify you?
Chair Holvey and Representative Riley, the first thing we'll do is verify the order. We will check with the creditor. We'll work with the party. If it looks like they're just not paid and it's not being appealed, we'll start proceedings to suspend the contractor's license. That will take a little bit of time under the present law, but it'll put people on notice that this contractor has a problem, and we likely will put that on the website.
Follow up?
No.
Representative Gilliam, question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Tell me just a little bit more about that. The main way we let them know that there's a problem is the website?
Chair Holvey and Representative Gilliam, when you say that, you mean the public?
Yes.
We receive thousands of hits per month on our website. We answer approximately 300 calls a day from consumers and other groups. So it's kind of a combination of both telephone and website.
Another question? Did you have a follow-up?
No, I'm sorry, I was ahead.
Representative Gerard.
Oh, thank you, Chair Holvey. The enforcement mechanism.
Chair Holvey and Representative Gerard, this would be made part of the enabling statute 701. You've authorized a civil penalty of up to $1,000 for a failure to comply with any provision of that statute, so it would be subject to a $5,000 fine. I would guess that first offenses wouldn't be that high, but they could be.
Further questions? I really see any as far as perhaps I can go down a particular road. What would, other than I suppose the risking a further fine for violating this, what would really make a contractor want to report to you that they've got a judgment against them?
Chair Holvey, I think you're right. I think that the one thing would be trying to keep from putting salt in their already open wound. You wouldn't want that enforcement action against your license for failure to disclose a judgment, because that is a disciplinary action against the contractor. It's my hope that most well-informed contractors, and once we get to do continuing education, of course, for new contractors that already have existing prerequisite education, this would be a self-enforcing type of provision. I mean, what it means is that it doesn't make a whole lot of sense if you're in business and if you lose in court not to pay that debt. Don't try to spring that along. We think that hurts the marketplace, and it would be my hope that we wouldn't have to enforce too many of these. When we do, of course, we'll take those actions.
And a follow-up for myself here before I turn it over to somebody else. I'm just sort of curious, in your exemptions, you exempt a contractor that pays that judgment within 30 days, and I'm just kind of wondering about fair treatment under the law. I don't know if I'm going anywhere with that, but it seems like if contractors had a judgment against them, that if you're going to list them, you should list all of them, and you're creating an exemption to listing some but not all. I kind of worry about your legal standing if someone were to, you know, come after you and go after state dollars because you're not treating them like everybody else. So do you have an answer for that?
Well, Chair Holvey, my first answer is I'm not a lawyer, and I wouldn't want to give any legal analysis to it. I can tell you this, that the board spent some time with this particular legislative concept, and they argued that point, that very point, went back and forth. The staff recommendation, frankly, was initially all judgments and court orders should be submitted. And after considerable discussion at the board level, board members determined that it wouldn't be fair for to get a black mark on your record if you went through the due process of court and you paid in a timely manner. And so they opted to seek a legislative fix that would only require contractors who lost in court, then just chose not to pay the debt, and require those individuals to report those judgments. And we did have counsel available at the time in case they wanted to ask any questions about it.
Thank you. I'd like to follow up with that, I guess, later perhaps, because I'm wondering if the court perhaps gave the contractor 45 days to pay and not 30. And so, I just see some discrepancies perhaps that might occur, and so I'm just a little concerned about those. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is It related to what Chair Holvey brought up, and from a policy standpoint, you could have a contractor who had a dozen or more judgments for negligent or improper work in a residential structure, and none of those would be reported if they were paid, but you could have a contractor who had one unpaid judgment, and that would be paid. And I guess that my concern is that I don't necessarily see a reporting of a fact, such as the existence of a judgment, as a black mark. I think the black mark is the unpaid debt, perhaps, but the existence of a judgment I don't see as a black mark. So from a policy point of view, even though the judgment is public record in a court, I just struggle a little bit with why we're drawing the line at only unpaid judgments as opposed to multiple. There could be multiple judgments for improper work, and that wouldn't be disclosed, but one unpaid judgment would. That wasn't really a question. It was more of a statement questioning the policy.
Chair Holvey and Representative Bonamici, I would not disagree with you, and that's what's gone through my mind as well. The problems we've had with contractors, again, most contractors are stellar. There's no problem with them. But the problem with the 1% that gets into trouble with unpaid judgment has been fairly large. And we would like to see this public policy advanced baby steps, if not full steps. And, you know, at this point, this was as good as I can get without having opposition.
Thank you. Representative Riley,
thank you.
Question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. You've had a few of these in the past, I assume, and I just wonder what's the amounts of these unpaid debts? Are they, that sort of a broad...
Right. Chair Holvey and Representative Riley, they range all the way from a few hundred dollars up to hundreds of thousands of dollars, and if not more. I can recall a case of $130,000. We've had situations with McGilvra that Representative Nelson referred to last week with, again, hundreds of thousands of dollars of unpaid material dealers and other debts. And it's just very, very tough for consumers. And, of course, the consumers are looking for one place to shop for viability of a construction contractor. We think that ought to be your CCB website, and this would allow us to at least show debts that weren't paid, or, obviously we would anticipate some contractors won't be truthful with us, some very bad ones, but once we find out about them, we'll be able to discipline those contractors, and that'll go on the record.
Quick follow-up, if I may.
Follow-up, Representative Riley.
So, The people who have hundreds of thousands of dollars, first of all, they're not going to tell you because it's a $5,000 fine, and we all know that they've got lawyers to tell them which is worse, the $5,000 or being put out of business on their next contract. So your second line of penalty is unlicensing, is that correct?
Yes. Chair Holvey and Representative Riley, yes, that would be kind of the second discipline. It would be the suspension of the license. And I guess the other comment I'd make is you'd be surprised how fast the person who's owed the money learns that there might be something the state can do. It kind of motivates us to reach out to the contractor and motivates the contractor not to, again, add salt to their already open wound by failing to do the right thing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much, Craig, for that. Next up, I have, Sharon Cumby. Is that correct? Welcome today.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful day outside, and we're stuck inside listening to things about the construction contractors, but we know it's pretty important to a lot of people, and if you would just state your name for the record, please.
Chair Holvey, my name is Sharon Cumby. I'm a single homeowner, retired on a fixed income, and I would like to give some input on House Bill 2107.
Thank you.
I basically agree with the substance of this bill, but I think either some wording needs to be added or something, because at this point, if a contractor has a judgment or arbitration suit against him, he can file bankruptcy, and that will not appear in his record, and he could continue being licensed in the state of Oregon. And I, at this time, feel that they should have to pay these judgments. I feel that they should not be able to file bankruptcy and get out from under the debt that the homeowner has incurred because of building practices.
Thank you. That's very short, to the point. I think yes. We all understand exactly where you're coming from. We've had that issue come up, and we've talked about the ability of contractors to do just what you've described, and unfortunately the U.S. bankruptcy courts have not gone along with the state of Oregon's wishes to disallow us from issuing another license yet to the contractor who's declared bankruptcy. So it does bring up another point, though, that maybe we will we'll consider talking about some more does that unpaid debt follow that individual to the next company? Probably not, I'm guessing, but it's something that we might ask.
Well, in my instance, right now I am $266,000 in debt. Mm. We haven't had arbitration, which will cost at least $20,000 for witnesses. And the contractor is threatening to file bankruptcy if I get a judgment against him.
Mm. Questions from the committee? You've left us speechless, obviously. You know, this is one of the big issues that we're trying to deal with and get our hands around in this committee, and it's a very difficult situation with bankruptcy protections of these individuals, and our state's inability to address that is quite evident. So I appreciate your testimony today, and we're going to take your words and your instance to heart and put our heads together and see if we can help address this by some method. We've got several bills that are trying to address this overall problem, and perhaps a combination of them will try to reduce the amount of contractors out there that are practicing what I think is quite criminally. Thank you for your testimony today.
I would be willing to help at any point and share my input.
Thank you. Thank you for coming today.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on House Bill 2107.
Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we ask Mr. Smith to come back for just a moment? I'd like to ask him a follow-up question in response to Ms. Crumby's testimony.
That would be quite helpful, I suppose, and I'm sure he'd be more than willing to come forward. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Smith, you heard Ms. Cumby's testimony. Could you explain what happens from the CCB's point of view when you receive information that a contractor has filed bankruptcy? How do you handle it in the CCB?
Okay. And could you re-identify yourself for the record so people out there in radio land can understand who you are again?
Chair Holvey, for the record, members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. I'm with the Construction Contractors Board. The question is, what happens when we hear that a contractor has filed for protections under the bankruptcy law? There is an automatic stay. The first thing we do is contact our assistant attorney generals who have expertise in bankruptcy law to analyze the type of bankruptcy it is. We cannot do enforcement activities while someone has filed bankruptcy. If indeed a debt, whether it be a CCB debt or a court judgment, is ultimately discharged, we are prevented from allowing that to be the basis for suspending the contractor's license. And it also prevents at this time, although this is relatively new, We used to do the opposite. At this time, after the discharge of the debt, we're unable to keep the individual who was responsible for that company from starting a new company. So it is truly, in essence, a get-out-of-jail-free card. It is frustrating for consumers. I think it's frustrating for the industry. I know it's frustrating for regulators. We tried to enact some fairly creative solutions over the last years, but as I testified to, we recently lost a case in the United States Bankruptcy Court, and we have stopped keeping new companies from starting where the principal was responsible for the debts that were discharged in bankruptcy. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
So, Representative Riley.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. And that's federal law that you're talking about.
Yes. Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, it is.
Thank you.
So I have a follow-up to that. So if, in fact, we implemented a law similar to 2107, would there be anything that would prevent us in this bankruptcy rulings to post on the website the judgment and the previous bankruptcy and the amount of unpaid debts that resulted from that bankruptcy on the website?
Chair Holvey, I think you might have just hit on where we're headed, which is maybe we can't do discipline, but maybe, like private enterprise, we can be made aware of a certain activity that has taken place. You know, every time I go to file for a credit card or get a loan, if my debts have been discharged, my loan company knows about it, and they make a decision based upon that. Maybe other Oregonians, when they're hiring a contractor, ought to at least know if someone has discharged debts in bankruptcies. We've worked with the AG's office. We haven't got a complete answer to this, but I can tell you that what I'm hearing is that bankruptcy laws would not prevent the agency from issuing information on its website that says that a contractor either has discharged debts in bankruptcy, which we currently do, or that has unpaid judgments that have been discharged in bankruptcy. Now, that being said, it's always possible that the AG's office might change their mind. You know, our lawyers might change their mind. There might be court cases that come up. But at this point, we think that that is an interesting policy question. We think that that might be absolutely the right thing to do, and it might very well be very legal.
So a follow-up to that, would this House Bill 2107 as amended allow us to go down that road if, in fact, it is legal for us to post that information?
Chair Holvey, I believe it does.
Thank you.
Quick follow-up on
that. Representative Riley.
And would that include new companies of principals of companies, other companies, having filed bankruptcy?
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, what I'm hearing you say is, if they start a new company, could you put that onto the new company? That might be a little bit more problematic. Currently, we provide cross-references, so if you're looking for me, and I used to have a company with my friend Mark Long, and I filed bankruptcy, and make a long story short, Mark started a new company, you'd be able to see a cross-reference that looks at Mark's and my previous partnership, but there wouldn't be all that negative stuff just on Mark's license. Does that make sense?
Follow-up, Representative Riley?
The cross-reference that you're talking about, if I start up a new company, if I have a previous company and I start up a new company and it doesn't say Chuck Riley Enterprises anymore like it used to, it now says Good Guys Enterprises, is that cross-reference right on that company? Good Guy Enterprises is run by Chuck Riley, who used to run Chuck Riley Enterprises?
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, the way we do it is right up front it shows a box that says associated cross-reference license numbers. And then we've made it very handy so a person who's trying to check up the history that flows from this current business to all the other businesses that might be associated with it, they have to hit that one extra punch on the key, but we get there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee?
Just a comment. Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
I think that Mr. Smith and Mr. Long should declare their conflict of interest.
Yes.
This company that
Sir, being friends, you mean?
Well, no, this company that he was talking about.
I'm sure he was speaking of a hypothetical business.
Absolutely.
I have a follow-up before Mr. Smith escapes.
Representative Bonamici, it's not too late.
So do you, Mr. Smith, anticipate that a judgment from a bankruptcy court would be included under the existing language of 2107, which just says a judgment issued in a court action?
Chair Holvey, Representative Bonamici, no, I don't. It talks about for damages, for negligent or improper work or breach of contract, and a judgment, I think, in a bankruptcy court would be other than that. If indeed it's part of that, I'd have to give that some more thought. I'd never thought about it that way. Obviously, to continue with the answer, a bankruptcy court doesn't order certain payments to be made the way an ordinary breach of contract claim would be.
Sorry, just a clarification.
Representative Galizio, of course. You haven't spoken yet.
So absent this bill, 2107, you would continue to consult with the AG's office to find out if you could post the information that we've just been talking about? Or are you saying specifically in concert with this bill?
Chair Holvey, Representative Galizio, kind of a multi-question there. The first answer is yes, absent this bill, we'd continue to do what we're doing, which is to post debts that have been discharged in bankruptcy, and frankly, we post it rather prominently on the website. So if you're looking at my license, and I've discharged thousands of dollars or whatever in bankruptcy, it's listed right on my license. And in a world after 2107, should you decide to pass that, I think that just give us some more tools to get that job done.
Okay. Thank you.
And for the record, that's a hypothetical license.
Yes, it is.
Further questions from the committee?
As was mine.
seeing none. Thank you very much for bringing that to the attention of the committee, and thank Ms. Cumby for letting us think about this a little longer. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2107? Seeing none, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2107. And in light of some of the comments made here today, we're going to not work this bill today. I think we want to put our heads together a little bit more and talk about some of the implications of our conversations and see if this bill can be made yet a little bit better. So with that, I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2221. Steve, would you give us a little preview of House Bill 2221?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2221 establishes licensing requirement for person marketing, offering for sale or selling, promoting, distributing, or administering discount medical plans.
Thank you. And up first, we have someone from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, Joel Ariel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Ariel. I'm the administrator with the Insurance Division, the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Here today to testify again in support of House Bill 2221, but I do have to say that we just got the amendments this morning. They're fairly extensive, and they include a number of changes beyond what we had additionally submitted as proposed changes. So we think they're okay, but there are some disputes about what some of the new terminology that we had not seen until this morning means, and so I would ask the Chair's indulgence to have that reviewed among my staff and then with some of the interested parties in order to make sure that the words accomplish our purposes.
Thank you for that. Do I have questions from the committee of Mr. Ariel? I know we've heard this bill before, and we're mostly just wanting to review the amendments, and sorry that we didn't get them quite in time to have a proper preview. They're a little more complicated, as I agree, and so I want to make sure we do what we do is we do it, try to do it right. So let's take a little time to review this, and then we'll reschedule for a further public hearing and possible work session.
Thank you. And I certainly recognize it's not your fault and it's not legislative council's fault. It's just a matter of the process, and much prefer to get it right here in the House rather than end up with some disputes in the Senate in a week or two.
Absolutely, I agree, and I appreciate that. So no questions of you at this time. We'll go ahead and... Representative Bonamici, I was wrong. There is a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Arroyo, for being here. Have you had time to ascertain in your short time with the Dash 1 amendments if they are in part or in whole or in part based on the Model Act? Because I know that that's something that we talked about in the previous public.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I believe they're in general inconsistent with the Model Act, but that is one of the issues that we want to check. There are some of the definitional issues as to who's in and who's out of the licensing requirement here that we do want to be consistent with the model on, and we're not quite sure how some of the moving pieces here relate to each other.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson, a question?
Yes, thank you. This just surprised me. Have we not, prior to this, been in the business of numerous businesses selling discount medical plans? I mean, I'm kind of amazed this is just now coming up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, there have been these kind of plans out there in the marketplace. They haven't been subject to regulation as long as they're not insurance products, and most of them are not insurance products, and but we have had some problems, and people have believed them to be good substitutes for insurance products, and that's why we're proposing this regulation.
Got it.
Thank you for reminding us of that. Further questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Ariel, for your testimony today. Next up, we have Elise Brown.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Elise Brown, representing America's Health Insurance Plans, which represents about 1,300 members across the country, insuring over 200 million Americans. And it was nice to hear Commissioner Ariel's testimony. We, too, actually just received the amendments just before committee started this afternoon. So we are quickly trying to review those amendments and appreciate the committee's willingness to put this off so that we can get our arms around that. A couple of the things I wanted to point out, though, that I didn't see in the Dash 1s that I hope that we can, with the committee's indulgence, entertain as well. And it was great to hear Representative Bonamici just ask the question about the Model Act. Section 8 does have some issues that we'd like to see clarified in terms of disclosure. And in the name of the Model Act, Section 8 on the refundable fees and cancellations, I think in conjunction with the Model Act, you'd see that most states allow the one-time installation fee to be intact, and what would be refunded would be the 30-day, monthly, any other additional fees, but that installation fee would remain intact. And then in subsection 4 of Section 8, most states, and this is in the NAIC model, require that the disclosures be in 12-point font. And we would ask that the committee consider that as opposed to the bold and prominent type that's listed in the bill. So with that, any questions? Otherwise, we hope to work with you to make those clarifications.
Questions from the committee? Seeing none, I appreciate your input on this, and you can either work with the committee administrator with your thoughts or with Joel Ariel with DCBS or both, and I appreciate that input.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee.
Further taking notes here, there was a slight pause in my oratory. Is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 2221? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2221. And as indicated, we won't be working this bill either. I'm going to make sure we have time to properly review this and make sure all the considerations to this bill are made. And with that, I'm going to open up public hearing on House Bill 2781. Steve, would you give us a little preview of House Bill 2781?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2781 requires the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to appoint a Construction Contractors Insurance Advisory Committee.
Thank you. First up, we could have Joel Aereo again with the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Joel Aereo. I'm the administrator with the Insurance Division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Here today to testify in support of House Bill 2781. If I put on my Mark Long hat, I would tell you that this, again, is one of the recommendations from the task force to the legislature to help deal with the contractor liability crisis that we faced in this state. It is the last of the insurance recommendations. You've heard three other insurance recommendations. This is the fourth. In some ways, it may be the most important one, because one of the issues that the task force wrestled with was that when we tried to get data on exactly what is going on in the contractor market in Oregon, we found it very difficult to get that data from the insurance companies. And so we have this proposal to create an advisory committee to drill down on that problem in ways that we weren't able to drill down on it during the task force. I do think we can get more data than we have from the insurance industry. I've frankly been quite disappointed in what I've seen in terms of their cooperation with us on this issue. I will note, however, that there are a couple complexities here that you will hear about from them that do make this more difficult than some other data issues. The first of those is that, unlike most of the data issues we wrestle with in the department, where there's ongoing annual reporting to us, line item reporting under definitions that are commonly agreed to not only in this state but nationally, so you can compare apples to apples, this type of coverage, contractor liability coverage, is lumped into a broader category called general liability. And it includes retail liability policies, it includes manufacturing liability policies, and so you have reporting to us at a much larger level of general liability, and not necessarily, well, we don't get annual reporting of this category broken out from that. So when we try to break it out, when we go back to the carriers during the task force, and we've done it prior to the task force as well, and ask for the contractor categories, we get a lot of, well, what do you mean by that term, and what do you mean by this term? And for instance, one of the terms is construction defect. There is no definition that's agreed upon among the insurers on construction defect. They define it differently. And then, of course, most of the companies that are here are national companies. So if we try to talk about an Oregon-based definition, then we get into issues of, well, we're supposed to have a special definition for you different than all the other states. So that's the kind of dialogue. That's one set of problems that we face in trying to get adequate data. The second issue is, even if we get inside that contractor liability category, you know, 42,000 contractors, so if we can get to that category, we can get to the bucket of contractor liability, and we can see what the losses are in aggregate for each insurer for their all of their coverages within those within the contractor liability category. But then when you start asking the next level of question, well, are they all one class? Well, no, there are actually 128 different classes within the contractor liability category. So those 42,000 contractors are across 128 different categories. And when you try to drill down into those categories, most of the insurers don't have statistically credible data in most of those categories in Oregon. So what they actually rely on to, as a starting point for their rating is national data that that has relativities for each of those 128. So say there's $100 total in the contractor category, $100 million to make it more real, then they align the different categories based on data that is national in scope because of the lack of statistically credible data here. So you have that coming into the starting point. And then when you say, well, how does that line up with Oregon experience? And you get to the last part of the puzzle here, which is then they all, having started with those relativities, do put some Oregon-based experience modifiers into the mix. And so some number of the contractors in Oregon do have modifiers that are based on actual experience in Oregon. That's just a quick summary of the kinds of issues that we got into there. Originally, the task force wanted a proposal that would have specified to the legislature exactly what kind of data to collect and exactly what kind of fashion. But for the reasons I just kind of summarized, we couldn't drill down far enough. And again, I'll just be frank again, I'm disappointed that we didn't get enough cooperation to be able to produce that. So we come to you with a bill that essentially says, give us the authority to sit down with people and say, we want the specific data. We're going to get into the technical details here, and we need to have the data that can show us basically two things, as the bill says, the affordability and availability of this insurance, what is the record. And we're particularly interested in only a small number of categories. The construction contractor liability crisis is not a crisis across those 128 categories. It's mostly in the envelope, so-called envelope category, you know, the window, doors, that sort of thing. And that's where we really want to focus our attention. And then we also want data that shows us, are the reforms, assuming the legislature does pass some number of reforms here, we'll be able to measure, are they actually working? Are they helping the problem? So that's what we're after in the data. The bill simply authorizes the director, my boss, the department, to create a task force and it's got three parts to it. It says who should be on it. Right now it just says insurers, at least one rep from insurers, contractors and consumers. And consumers here I assume means the homeowners, the people who actually are getting the product from the contractors. I think you'll see an amendment from the industry that says let's have at least two from the insurance industry. We probably need at least two from all of the industries, so we'd be fine with that recommendation. Second part is, what is the task force's charge? And it is to make recommendations, not binding decisions, but recommendations to the director on what kind of data could help on affordability and availability, as well as on measuring the success of the reforms. And then finally, the third part of the bill charges the director to provides that she may adopt some of those data recommendations, and to reflect the fact that you, and you'll hear this ad nauseum from the industry, that when we get into this, the cost of collecting the data may outweigh the value of the data. That could turn out to be true. I mean, that's our problem. We've still been trying to get to the data issue. So the bill does have language to reflect that, that says when we get to the data point, we're not just going to mindlessly require data from people if we don't think that it will actually be cost-effective to collect it and be helpful to us when it is collected. So that's a quick summary of this bill. Again, I wish we could provide you with something more definitive here, but that's the state of the discussion today.
Thank you. Representative Galizio, a question?
I do. This is a hypothetical. Let's say that you found out that the costs that were the premiums that were charged far outweighed the risks to the insurance companies. I mean, just the pricing was ridiculous. What can DCBS do about that? You get this data and you say, oh, this is incredible. This data shows that, you know, we're being over. I mean, what do you do with that information?
Mr. Chair, Representative Glizzo, good question. Two things. One, first thing would be to go back to the companies and jawbone with them, and that oftentimes does change the result. Second thing, if we got to an issue where they said, we don't care, this is our filing, you take legal action against us, we have the authority to change rates or disapprove or issue, I think technically we'd have to issue a cease and desist order on this kind of situation, because it is a file and use system where they file it and then they can use it. So we end up issuing a cease and desist. But our bottom line authority in the in these property and casualty markets, unlike the health markets where we have clear authority here, we only have the authority to do that kind of activity if we find that the market is not a competitive market. So it's a rather cumbersome process that we would have to go through. But on your hypothetical, if everybody's charging rates that are outrageously high against the market, that would, to my mind, make a prima facie case of an uncompetitive market, and we would have the authority. But there is, it's important to note that there is that step in the process on the property and casualty side of saying that the market, finding that the market is not competitive.
Thank you very much.
Representative Gilliam, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joel, do you have other advisory groups like this for other parts of the insurance industry that your department is charged with?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, yes, we do, but that touches on an important point that I should have mentioned earlier, which is typically they're one-time or ad hoc sort of groups that they come into play for a while and then and go away. We have very few institutional ones. We do have one on the health side that we've had for more than 10 years now, but the bill isn't clear in its current language as to whether this is a one-time deal or a permanent advisory committee, and our recommendation will be in the, if and when the bill moves, to recommend that it be not a permanent one.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Gilliam.
So the language, then, I haven't checked it, is you're saying is it's not permanent, but you would support it being permanent. Or the reverse.
The reverse, yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam. We would, the language just says a point when it doesn't clarify whether it is permanent or not. We would like the language to be clarified to say that it is organized for a purpose and it should disband when the purpose is fulfilled.
Last follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Whatever deficiencies there were from the industry in getting good information, are you hopeful if this bill passes that by their representation with one or two members, that flow of information would improve?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I am hopeful that with the industry here in Oregon, we can sit down and work these things out. There are two complications with this particular issue. One is that some of the companies we're dealing with are national companies, and oftentimes they, particularly if they have a relatively small sliver of the market in this area, kind of take the attitude of, if you make community problems for me, I'm not going to be doing business in your state. That's one kind of problem. The second is that some of this business, about 15%, today, I believe, is in what's called surplus lines. It means that the people can't, contractors can't get coverage from the normal licensed carriers in Oregon, and in that situation, Oregon law allows those people who are simply don't have a choice in the admitted market, it's called, to use so-called surplus lines carriers. Those carriers are largely outside of our regulatory control. We do propose in this bill, and I think it's very important that it be part of this bill, that the legislature give us specific authority to collect information from the surplus lines carriers as well as from the admitted market to get a full picture. Having said that, you're going to hear from the industry that that ought to be a requirement in the bill. We don't like that to be an absolute requirement in the bill. We want the authority. The problem with making it a requirement is that Congress is right now considering a bill as part of a nationalization uniformity across states to prohibit every state except the domestic state from collecting data from surplus lines people. So the surplus lines people are in national capital these days saying, we're getting too many of these state data calls, and so you need to pass a law. And our people in D.C. tell me that bill, it passed unanimously last year when it was on the floor of the House, it might very well pass. So we may end up with one hand tied behind our back before we're done with this on surplus lines. Now, the difference between us and the industry is they'd say, then you ought to say in the bill, the whole thing stops. We'd say, no, some data is still better than no data, but it will, if we're restricted on the surplus line side, it will further make it more difficult for us to actually get our hands around this particular problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ario, if DCBS does not regulate surplus lines carriers, who does?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, we do regulate them for certain purposes, and we primarily regulate the agents who sell the product, and there are requirements that they don't get involved in selling until there's been a verification that there isn't anything available in the admitted market, and they pay taxes to the state, and so there are some forms of regulation. But in terms of some of the key issues here, like the form, the policy forms they use, those don't come through us. The rates they charge don't come through us. So it's not, I didn't mean to suggest, if I did, I misspoke, to that they're not regulated at all, but it's a much more limited form of regulation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Girard, question?
Yes, thank you, Chair Holmey. Maybe I need a course on Insurance 101. Could you go back again and tell me what the definition is of insurers in the surplus lines?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, you may test my knowledge fully here, but the basic concept of surplus lines, and I'm not going to be able to give you the legal definition, but the concept is if there is not insurance available in the admitted market, so if there's not insurance available from a licensed insurer, we did it almost exclusively on the property and casualty side here, then the law does allow a so-called surplus lines carrier to sell product to people under the theory that absent those products that those people would not have any insurance options. That's the theory of surplus lines. And by the way, surplus lines is a concept outside of the regulatory framework, is a concept that exists in all 50 states. So it's well accepted part of insurance regulation. It doesn't come into play very often in the normal markets that most of your constituents would be part of the cut there. So the consumer markets like homeowner and auto, but it does come into play in some of the commercial markets, particularly these commercial markets with a lot of subcategories and fairly small exposures. And so contractor liability is one category that has been a province of surplus lines for, I think it's about, is it 15 now, Joyce? About 15% of the market today. So it's been higher during the middle of the crisis, but it's about 15% today.
Follow up, Representative Girard.
Okay. Two quick questions, just kind of one following the other. One is, in this bill, don't you think we need to define what surplus lines is? And the second thing, if they don't comply, what's the enforcement mechanism?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, I think surplus lines is a defined term in the code, so this would pick up that definition, but you're right that it needs to be defined if it's not properly defined in the bill here. And then secondly, a good point, and that would be one of the, there are a number of, I didn't get into all of the technical amendments we'd need here, but one would be to give us specific authority over reporting in relation to surplus lines. The bill picks up our general authority for other types of violations by admitted carriers. I think it may need some language with regard to surplus lines, but I'd have to check that with my experts too. So, okay.
Further questions, Mr. Aereo? Mm-hmm. Mr. Aereo, just kind of a general question. I know this before this legislature, and I don't know if you've had time to review it or where it is at this point, but I know there's been proposed also a health insurance review board as well. Is this sort of akin to that, and as far as duties that are charged with this particular committee and that particular board, I suppose?
Mr. Chair, there are similarities and differences between the different lines of insurance in terms of the way rate review works. On the health side, we have more aggressive authority. The lines that we do regulate, which are individual, small group, and portability, we have what's called prior approval, meaning a rate can't be used in the market until we've specifically approved it. On the property and casualty side, that's true of workers' compensation, but most, I think that may be the only property and casualty line that's prior approval. I think there actually are a couple more title insurances in that category. But most types of property and casualty are what's called file and use, means the rate does have to be filed with us, can then be used. And if it were, typically companies do file early with us because they don't want the situation of something having to be undone in the marketplace. But in theory, if they didn't and there was a problem with their filing, we'd have to issue a cease and desist to stop a illegal rate in that market. So there are differences. And, for instance, workers' comp is a quite different process. And, yes, there is a bill that we're aware of that's brought by a very esteemed member of the legislature. I think we will hear and testify to that bill at some point, probably, on the broader concept of rate review and how it ought to apply to all the different lines of insurance.
Thank you. And just to follow up, so those differences would account for why that board might be permanent and this one would be temporary.
Mr. Chair, yes. This committee would not be, I think, likely to recommend a permanent data filing requirement that would be part of the ongoing rate and form review or annual statement process. It could link into one of those processes, but it would more likely be in the nature of a one-time or a few times in the next few years data calls to address the specifics of the market situation that we're facing today.
Thank you. Another question, Representative Girard?
Yeah, thank you, Representative or Chair Hovey. I'm still going back to this surplus lines. Do you have any current authority over that? And it would seem hard for me, if I'm getting the concept here, that it's a secondary insurance. I'm trying to understand how you could demand information from them if they might not even be in the market.
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, remember that as long as there's not a constitutional block to a particular type of practice, then you as the legislature can require what you want. As long as it's not either a federal preemption or a constitutional issue, you can require what you want. So the structure I gave you on surplus lines is a legislative creation. There's this whole chapter 735, that's devoted to surplus lines. And so to get the authority we need here would involve addressing some of the issues that currently, by legislation, are not areas that we can regulate. Some of that would have to change to give us the authority here. And you will hear from the insurers, and I agree with them on this, that if we're going to collect data and we have the ability, if the legislature has the ability to authorize us to collect from surplus lines, they should be included because they are a part of the market. And so we would ask for the maximum authority we can have from the legislature to address surplus lines. But you're just essentially changing prior legislation when you give us that authority.
Further questions? Curario, of course, this is early. This is the first hearing we've had on this. We don't see any fiscal impacts or anything like that. Seems like this would be a pretty perhaps cumbersome for the department with the FTEs involved in trying to do something like this. And if I'm not mistaken, this probably isn't anticipated in the governor's budget. If you care to comment about that just so we have a feel for where this may or may not be going.
Mr. Chair, yes, I don't believe there's likely to be a fiscal from us on this because, remember, what our job will be is to define what it is that has to be collected. You will hear from the companies their own versions of what it might cost them to meet those requirements and fit their data into the definitions, however they're agreed upon. But we believe this would be more in the nature of a typical type of process for us to define some kind of regulatory expectation through an advisory process, and then the real costs are the costs. The real costs have to be evaluated, the costs on the private enterprises that then have to meet that regulatory set of specifications.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, Mr. Ario, thank you very much for your testimony today and bringing this bill forward. Food for thought.
Thank you.
And next up, we have Jack Monroe.
Good
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe, speaking today on behalf of the American Insurance Association. And it's obvious that I should not share my comments with the administrator. You got a lot of, he will say, he won't say, sort of comments. But I think you obviously have a little bit of a flavor from Joel's remarks, that beside the facade, essentially, of a process bill, things get a little bit more complicated, and that's certainly true of this area. You know, we collect a lot of data, as was indicated. We collect a lot of data in specific formats for things like disclosing to this regulator and others our financial conditions, meaning that an individual company's financial condition, because certainly one of the charges of this regulator and every other regulator is to check solvency. And we also collect data and provide data for things like the rate filings that Representative Galizia was asking about. But I think you folks obviously all come from a variety of different backgrounds, but I think even in those backgrounds, you can understand that going back to retrieve data is both expensive and complicated. And so if you're going to do that, you have to be sure that whatever it is you're collecting is relevant, it's credible, and, in fact, it can be manipulated to prove whatever it is you want to prove. And in the course of this bill, it's to monitor any changes that the legislature eventually makes that are coming from that construction contractors task force, and to monitor availability and affordability, which I frankly think you could already do with the filing information that, again, Representative Galizia was asking about. So our concern about this measure really is with the expense and the complexity. And again, for reasons that were really already outlined, there are significant issues here, both with regard to the data set that you can get and whether it tells you anything, and with regard to the relevancy and credibility of any data you get. And the data set issue is the one that, you know, I think you probably have some flavor for with regard to the questions. You think of a pie, and that pie consists of 128, to use Joel's number, the numbers I've heard have been higher than that, but however many, many, many contractor classifications. And then you take a small portion of that pie, and that pie represents those critical classifications that, again, were referred to. And everybody outside that little wedge happens to be insured in the admitted market, which is the highly regulated market, or the more highly regulated market. And everybody inside that happens to be insured in the surplus lines market, which is regulation light, as was indicated earlier. If you just get data from admitted carriers, it's not going to tell you anything about what's going on inside the wedge. You won't know whether there's any impact on, any of these construction contractor task force recommendations have moved the numbers or changed anything. And then, again, not to drill down too deeply, but even if you get data, there are significant questions about how you can use it. And I would tell you a little history in terms of the way the Construction Industry Task Force looked at this issue. There was a lot of discussion both off the task force record and much less on early on about trying to identify bits of data that might be useful. And even in the provision zone analysis, they had to conclude that either this bit of information wasn't relevant, or this was going to cost a lot, or whatever. And just to give you one example, and I think maybe Joel used it earlier, I mean, I can give you loss data for one of those classifications, but that doesn't tell you whether that loss represents somebody having dropped a hammer
on the head of somebody passing by on the street, or whether it represents in one way or another a defect. And so, you know, it, once again, you have trouble with the relevancy and credibility of the data. So I have, as was indicated, I have at least two suggestions, and it sounds to me like there are other potential amendments, such as the Sunset Amendment and some and maybe some others. The First Amendment is a simple one, and that is, if you're going to establish a task force and indicate the composition of that task force, it ought to make sense in its smallest denominator. And this one doesn't. I mean, you could satisfy this statutory requirement and say there will be four people, but the first provision in Section 2, Sub 1, Sub A says that there will be one representative from insurers, including insurers in the surplus lines. Well, you know, if you only had one, it would have to be a surplus lines insurer. And we think that they perform, you know, a wonderful role, but if you're going to put together a task force, you ought to have a member of the admitted market, at least one member of the admitted market there. Now, I'm sure that, you know, that's a problem that that would resolve, but frankly, the statute ought to make sense. The more important change, I think, is one back in Section 3, Sub 1, Sub C. At least this is conceptually where I would think it ought to go. And that is, if you're going to ask for data, you need to ask for the same data and the same data sets from both the admitted and the non-admitted market, surplus lines market, for the reasons that I've briefly enunciated a minute ago. So, you know, we think that's frankly important, again, because if you only get data from a section of the market, you're not going to be able to tell anything that's relevant to, you know, the statutory missions that are laid out here. I also might respond to a couple of questions that were raised, and I think Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, asked an interesting question about if rates are excessive, essentially. And, you know, the regulator here has a statutory obligation to review rates for their either being unfairly discriminatory, excessive, or insufficient. And, you know, If the regulator were to find, for example, that rates were insufficient, they clearly would have the right to exercise the full panoply of their powers, because, you know, they wouldn't want to be dealing with an insolvency situation a year or 2 years or whatever. The same thing is true with excessive rates. They have the authority and have a full panoply of powers to deal with those issues. I also found the discussion about the response to Representative Gilliam's question to be, a little bit quizzical, in the sense that what you essentially were told was that the federal government may preempt the market here, and I guess as the responses to Representative Girard's questions would indicate, that we apparently don't really have the authority to ask them for information now. But frankly, if they are preempted, meaning if we don't have the ability to ask for data from surplus lines carriers, then this whole exercise is moot, because it's not going to tell you anything. It'll result in a considerable expense if the authority is exercised, and an expense that, frankly, will end up ultimately being borne by insureds in the state of Oregon, because, you know, these are costs that will end up in rates. I mean, this is not a collection exercise that will go through without incurring expense, and those expenses will end up being part of somebody's rates. So I think with that, I'd be obviously happy to answer any questions, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Galizio.
Mr. Monroe, if the committee adopted the amendments, what would the American Insurance Association's position on the bill be? Opposed, neutral, or supportive?
Well, this is a process bill, so you know you have some problems in the get go, I guess, in saying, gee, we, you know, aren't wild about the process. But I would guess my response would be I'd have to be neutral.
Thank you, Representative Riley. Oh, you got a follow up, Galizio?
Well,
sure.
Follow up in that it's behind the last question, but I don't know if it's a little different.
Well, while you're on the queue, let's go ahead. And
All right. It shouldn't take too long. Would you agree with the premise of this that availability and affordability of liability insurance for contractors is a significant problem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, you know, the whole issue of availability and affordability is always an interesting one because, you know, there's never a sort of bright line in the sense that there's probably not a one of you that don't think you're paying too much for whatever your insurance coverage is, your automobile or your homeowners or whatever. But if you can get it, and you can get it at a reasonable price, it's available. It's affordable. At some point in time, and it probably varies from, you know, from person to person or entity to entity, affordability becomes such that, you know, something is, for all intents and purposes, at least as it might relate to them, it's unavailable. And you know, I don't know that I've answered your question. I think the market would suggest right now that that in fact, with certain classifications, given the fact that the surplus lines market is essentially satisfying those needs, that there is that whatever's going on in that portion of the market is so unattractive that admitted carriers aren't willing to take that risk. So they're in that area, probably you can make a case for the fact that there are affordability and maybe availability problems, although if they're covered in the surplus lines market, there's available insurance. So
this is a follow-up.
Follow-up for Sam Galizio.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at you represent the insurance association, mm-hmm. So I wanted your, I mean, we could all have opinions, but you're the professional. That's what I was looking for. So so you talked about concerns about how complicated it is, that it's costly to gather this data, and it can be manipulated. So isn't that the purpose of having at least one member of the insurance industry on the task force so that they could provide clarification, because being a professional and understanding the industry, you could provide context? Isn't that the whole purpose of...
Well, I'm sure that's the purpose, because, Chair Holvey, Representative Galizio, I mean, as I've explained, insurance companies collect a lot of data because it's a data business, right. And they collect much of that data, and their systems are set up to produce that data in a report format, let's say, that complies with NAIC structured financial reporting formats, you know, and they're used in every state in the country. Same thing is pretty much true, I think, in the rating area. You know, there's great consistency there. But if you, other than that, the other data that's out there is set up and even categorized and whatnot with their business operational model in mind. And so it's not necessarily the same from company to company, and it's certainly not a case of punching a button and getting a report that includes the following elements. And as I've said, even if you were to be able to produce that and punch that button, in some cases the data you're going to get isn't capable of telling you exactly what you think you might want to hear. And I used the paid losses example a minute ago. And that is, you can't tell whether it was the, you know, a hammer falling on somebody's head or a construction defect claim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I'm glad you brought that last one up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a long career as a data analyst, and I worked in insurance companies a bit. And I find it highly suspect that you don't know if it was a hammer falling or if it was a construction defect that caused this this claim. And I suspect that, that most companies would be able to tell us that. Also, I guarantee you that almost every company out there is able to produce ad hoc reports if the CEO wants it. So to say that because it's not in a format that currently is reported out is, to me, okay, well, I know you can report, you can do ad hoc reports. Yes, there's a little bit of, there is cost. You have to have a, you have to have someone write a little bit of a little bit of code to get this, probably some SQL statements, if you will. But we know that this can be done in a matter of days. So I also want to say that I believe that as was stated earlier, when analyzing data, yes, if you don't have all the data, it's not as good. If you have some data, it's better than no data. And if you know which data is missing, that's even better. So I'd like to have you respond to all those comments. It was a whole string of things.
Chair Holby, Representative Riley, you know, the last thing anybody who's in my position wants to hear is, you know, you've fallen into my trap, which is, I guess, the preface for your questions. But the let me answer in the following sense. In many cases, of course, what the system now, what an individual company's system will retain and want to retain is that for this risk, they paid this loss. And you might be able to, if you went back through every file individually, be able to tell, you know, which ones seem to be a hammer drop and which ones were a construction defect. Even then, there isn't a common definition, apparently, of what, you know, what a construction defect really is. And so that's a problem. So, I mean, if you're going back and requiring people to go through each file to determine, then, you know, that's going to be an interesting exercise. I think, you know, another issue, as was indicated in the administrator's comments, for a great many people, they are, again, national companies writing, you know, in a great many states, including Oregon, maybe a small share, a very small share of the Oregon market, which might range from doing anything from ensuring an Oregon exposure of a national company that's operating elsewhere. And, you know, just by way of summary, I mean, at some point in time, this process of, let's say, extracting and whatnot data for Oregon will end up being a burden, as was suggested by the administrator, that might keep them from, you know, wanting to be interested in being here, simply because the costs of doing so and the complexities of doing so simply aren't worth the premium they're writing. So.
Thank you. Do you have a follow-up?
Very quick. On the last point, I think I agree to some degree with that. I mean, if it's a small part of their business, they'll certainly use that to keep from having to do what we ask. But in the other regards, I think, you know, it's really... I would like to see some acceptance of the need for this data, because I believe it is needed data for us to be able to figure out the things that we, you know, how are we doing when we make a change in this body to a product or to a process. We'd like to know that it worked. And if we have data to show us what the results were from that change, this would help us immensely.
Well, you know, I might, Chair Holby, just a conclusory comment, and that is that, you know, I think even the administrator would suggest that we operate with the regulators in the state of Oregon on what I would consider to be a very cooperative basis. And, you know, we provide a variety of different services and information to the regulator. And so it's just, you know, the issue here is more complicated than the fact that we're just resistant to providing for providing data. I've suggested maybe not very completely, but that it's a lot more complicated than I think we'll even have a chance to explore this afternoon in terms of why some bits of data are difficult to get a hold of. They won't necessarily tell you what you need to know, and the fact that if you can't get a representative sample of the entire market, then you're not going to know whether or not the changes have made any, you know, have made a significant impact on whatever the availability or affordability issue might be in that area.
Thank you, Mr. Monroe. I was wondering before you step down if in fact, hypothetically, if we move forward with this concept or this bill, if the American Insurance Associations would be willing to perhaps give us a list of what, given some specific goals that would be created by this committee, of what would be a credible data, because you often referred to that the data, you know, would likely not be credible. If we could get some sort of idea of what credible data, in your mind, what would it look like? What would the parameters of credible data be? That might be helpful to look at it some point in the future.
Well, Chair Holby, I mean, I think we sort of struggled with that a little bit during the context of the earlier discussions, and the administrator and I have had sort of very general discussions about, because there actually are some databases out there that are sort of collective databases that the insurance services offices, which Representative Riley might be familiar with, it's a group that collects data from various companies for the purpose predominantly of rate filings, but they also do forms. And, you know, some data, but probably not complete data, might well be available from that source. But we've, you know, I know that discussions occurred between the division and that source, and while, you know, there's a certain willingness to provide some information, they can't provide some of the other information because they just don't have it in that form. So, we're at a particular point in time, and we obviously, they haven't been able to put together a complete list of the data that that they would ask for, even if it were available.
Well, I guess what I was asking was offering you to give some suggestions on what that credible data would be, and with that, I appreciate your testimony today. And we've got just a few minutes left and a couple of more people on the agenda, so I'd like to call up Scott Berry and Sharon Cumby, if you don't mind coming up together so we can at least get both your testimony in. Into the record.
So I'll go ahead and get started. Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association, and I will make my comments extremely brief. I think as a task force looked at this particular issue, our interest from the building industry was to try to gain some knowledge of what was causing the defects without waiting the 10-year period it may take, and I'm just throwing that 10-year number out there for the insurance industry to come up with some actuarial showing, you know, what the problems were and where they came from. At that point, we're 10 years farther down the road. I think our interest was trying to determine what was causing the defects, and then assuming we get some sort of continuing education process through this legislature, our interest is in then taking that information on where the defects are and saying, here's where we need to focus our education or a piece of our education, and maybe fixing that that problem before it gets too far down the road and continues to cause more problems. So had we known 7 years ago, 5 years ago, that it was going to be envelope issues and water intrusion and potentially, you know, energy code and the way we're now building that envelope, that our practices needed to change, would we have known that earlier with something like this? I think that's, you know, our hope, again, is not to get rate information or to get information about premiums and costs. Our interest is in where are the problems and can we educate our folks to avoid those in the near future. And that's where we were. And I don't know how difficult it is to collect it. I don't have any knowledge or background in that field. So that's, I think, the purpose we had in trying to gain some information about where the defects were coming from.
With that, I'd like to hear Ms. Gumby's statement.
Thanks, Chair Hovey. My name is Sharon Cumby. I also am interested in this bill and have some leanings toward what could or could not be done. I believe that if the insurance company could provide the names of construction companies, their rates, whatever the committee decides would be necessary, I think that should be fairly easy to start if they don't already have all the information that this committee would decide would be necessary. I worked for Oregon Department of Transportation for 27 years. I worked putting together simple programs to retrieve information when it was beyond my expertise, and we had programmers that could do it. I would like to see that done. I know that I had a license to do permanent makeup for 2 years, and for each year I had to have $1 million insurance on myself and $1 million insurance on the landlord that I rented from. I think by knowing where our problems are, that we can reduce these problems and just hold the contractor responsible and pay for what he's responsible for, if that is what is determined, or maybe they would no longer be in business. It could be, a lot of ways to go with it. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee of either two of the panelists? Representative Girard.
Oh, thank you, Chair Holmey. The question is, for me, is if we even need this bill. And so the testimony that we had was that the major problem seems to be in the envelope. That seems to be the rates that are kind of going up through the roof and, you know, with the mold lawsuits, et cetera. If you're not interested in rates of the insurance companies, I'm trying to understand why you need, what kind of data are you looking for to address that issue?
Chair Holder, Representative Durant, I think our interest, again, is finding out what the next envelope issue is. And in other words, trying to identify where the problems are occurring in construction as they occur. Where are the claims coming from? What are the biggest problems we're having? If it's 80% in envelope today and tomorrow it's 70% in flashing issues, or it's 60% in foundations because some new foundation product has come out. I think that's the information we're interested in having so that we can correct that problem as it relates to how we are constructing the houses. That's our interest.
Further questions? I just wanted to add perhaps just for my own brain here in this, in your comments about this specific bill, where this bill comes from the task force and looking at an insurance advisory committee, that I'm sure the task force must have felt there was some issues with the rates of the insurance or the availability of the insurance going up in this industry, and I think the task force was trying to address that specific issue, and you're referencing the claims as perhaps being the driver of lack of availability, perhaps, or the cost of the liability insurance, and trying to make that correlation. So I don't know if you want to comment on that, because you're speaking specifically more of the task force recommendations about solving the actual defect problems as opposed to perhaps how that's related to the insurance aspect of this bill.
Right, and I think that is a separate but important piece of the information. There's no doubt that we, when 20, 2078 passed last session, our interest was in what we're getting with insurance, exclusions that are allowed or not allowed, potentially the availability, the surplus line. I think we saw a spike in our folks using that surplus line insurance because the availability just wasn't there. And it really disappeared in specifically attached housing and condo projects. And some of our folks simply weren't able to build the condominium projects or the attached housing projects they had already platted because they couldn't get insurance. And that insurance expired, and they could not renew it. And in some cases, they simply didn't build those projects. And I think that part of that was the number of claims that were coming in, specifically on attached projects and on condominiums. And so that's where we saw the big spike. In addition to the siding contractors and general contractors for, again, some of the envelope pieces. So I think there was, and there still is, an interest in what's provided and in terms of what the consumer is getting in the end of the day and what the contractor is getting in terms of coverage to make sure that what we're building is covered by the insurance, because in the end, that's where the protection comes from for the consumer as well.
Thank you. It's sort of, I guess it disturbs me a little bit to know that, you know, because of that availability, we're not actually doing some of this work that's out there, part of our economy. And the reason you're not doing it is because you don't have the insurance, and by law, we require you to have that insurance to perform work. And so, I mean, that's a disturbing piece of this, how we put this whole thing together to keep our economy in this industry going, if it's being, I guess, diminished, not just to contractors, but our overall economy by the lack of availability, is what I'm hearing you say, of certain kinds of insurance lines.
Yeah, Chair Hogan, I believe that that certainly has occurred. I think the market, and I'm certainly no expert on the insurance market, but I know just from hearing from our contractors, I think at this point, availability is there for that specific set of projects that may involve attached housing. It certainly is much more expensive, and it tends to be, for some of our folks, towards that surplus line.
Thank you. Well, with that, I'm going to close this public hearing on House Bill 2781 and adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection. Thank you for your testimony today.